United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Judge Toth and Judge Falvey. We're convened today via video conference to hear argument in the matter of Hugh D. Cox versus Dennis McDonough, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 19-3317. Would counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter and Glenda Hurl, appearing on behalf of Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Good morning, Your Honors. Omar Yusuf for the Secretary, and with me at on second chair is Sarah Fusino.
Thank you, Mr. Yusuf. Mr. Carpenter, I assume you are reserving some time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please, Your Honor.
We'll make that happen, and you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The police court, this matter comes before the court on an issue of a dispute over attorney fees, a dispute that has carried on for quite some considerable time, more than a decade since the original decision in this matter. This matter was previously before the court in a single judge disposition by Judge Greenberg that sent it back to the board for reasons or basics. It is that proceeding back before the board that has raised several questions that pertain to the appropriate action and authority as well as jurisdiction of the board on remand to address certain issues. Specifically, the first issue is the question of the board's authority to review the question of entitlement to a fee under the provisions of 5904D. Mr. Cox's position is that 5904D is a separate and distinct procedure to determine whether or not there is eligibility to receive the fee called for in a fee agreement that is dictated by the terms of the statute. 5904D provides specific requirements in order to have the fee called for in the fee agreement withheld from the veteran or claimant's award of past due benefits. The board, in Mr. Cox's view, did not properly adjudicate and, in fact, improperly adjudicated by exceeding its authority to relitigate a question that had already been decided by the board in its 2014 decision. In so doing, Mr. Cox believes that the board exceeded its authority by relitigating that question and coming up with an answer different than the previous decision.
I jump in for one quick question. Just assume with me, and I know you disagree with this, but just assume with me that the veteran had good and adequate cause to discharge Mr. Cox. All right, just take that as a factual given. Okay. Under the contract that I'm assuming Mr. Cox drafted, I would be surprised if the veteran drafted it. But under the contract. The contract would say no fee. If all we were looking for is at the contract, do you agree with that?
That would be correct. Yes, yeah, sure.
Okay. So is it Mr. Cox's position then that in a situation where the veteran had good and adequate cause and the contract itself, the terms of the agreement between the parties would say you get no fee, what impact does that have at VA, in your view?
None.
So
the terms of the.
So I just want to pin that down. So the terms of the contract then have no bearing at all once the contract is found to be valid and the eligibility requirements have been satisfied. At that point,
that's correct, Your Honor. That is our.
Doesn't matter. So if I were going to write an opinion that said that, then I would say something like see or some type of cite. What would I cite for that proposition?
I believe the proper authority for that is this court's decision in Littman versus Nicholson. In Littman versus Nicholson, the panel in that decision specifically concluded that the board erred in determining that state law governed Mr. Littman's eligibility for the payment of attorney fees. It was a slightly different factual issue than the facts in this context, but I would believe that you would cite to Littman for the proposition that the terms of a fee agreement that go beyond the questions presented under Title 38 for eligibility to have a fee withheld under 5904D are not relevant or dispositive because those would be issues of state law. And this court in a number of cases has suggested to attorneys that if their fees are not withheld, then they have a remedy in state law to attempt to recover those fees. And that is the same.
It's okay. It's hard with the video. But on that point, I will tell you, when I first saw the case, you're dealing with a person who taught federal courts for a long time. And there's a line of cases in the federal courts world that talks about the assignment of a public, a private right to a non-Article III adjudicator. And that's the first thing my law professor mind went to. But I will tell you, although it's not a fulsome analysis, in Skates, the Federal Circuit has a paragraph that is written in the form of a question, which I don't quite know why it was written that way, but it says, what else but federal law would govern? And they were talking about a fee agreement in a 20% withholding case. So while I began being somewhat suspicious that this is essentially a public right, that appears to be what Skates said. And so I'd be interested in your views on that.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that's correct. At page 1369 of the Skates opinion, the Federal Circuit specifically observed that ordinarily state law controls attorney-client relationships. Here, however, the court observed that the federal statute provides for and governs the 20% contingent fee arrangement and the secretary's payment of that fee to an attorney out of the proceeds of the past due benefits. We believe that that is a correct statement of law. I do.
Mr. Carpenter, I'm going to hop in here and sorry to kind of double team you here with, but I understand that insofar as this would be kind of a preemption question, right, where there might be a conflicting, like a state law might conflict with a federal statute, then obviously the federal statute controls. But I think what Judge Allens is talking about is really like a Seventh Amendment right to a jury, that if VA here actually adjudicated this case based on whether there was good and adequate cause, the party that was negatively affected by that could claim that VA is effectively, taken away their right to have that question decided by a jury, right? And that's sort of the difference between a public and a private right. Is the private right, which would normally be a contract disputes or private rights, is something that a jury would be required to adjudicate. But you haven't raised that sort of question in this case.
No, Your Honor, because we see the remedy for this issue being part and parcel of the question of the reasonableness of the fee, and that the Congress has created two different tracks for the review of fee agreements.
Am I understanding correctly that what you're saying basically is that in no way does this case turn on whether the veteran had good and adequate cause to terminate Mr. Cox? That it turns on other issues.
Well, I hesitate to be quite so categorical as to in no way, because I believe that that can be and was a consideration made by the 2014 board decision. But the remedy, if you will, or the statutory basis for inquiry under Title 38 would appear under 5904C with the question of reasonableness, and that is a separate legal question in this case, because we have a disagreement between Mr. Cox and the government and the board, for that matter, as to which statutory provisions apply. The statutory provisions that were in place at the time the fee agreement was signed, or the statutory provisions that were in place at the time in which the contingency under 5904D was actually executed, meaning that there was an award of past due benefits. And we believe that you cannot review for reasonableness until there is a disposition of the contingency. Because clearly, if there is no award of past due benefits, then the attorney fee agreement has no effect. The attorney fee agreement only has effect when it meets the requirements under 5904D in order to trigger the responsibility of the secretary to withhold the benefits, to withhold up to 20% of those benefits and determine that the statutory requirements have been made for the payment of that money to the attorney. There is an entirely separate and independent track for the review of reasonableness, which must be executed by specific procedures, i.e. a motion for such review.
So what do you make of the language in 5904C about the secretary's own motion? I mean, you read that as a formal requirement.
I do, Your Honor. But we have to go back historically to the version of the statute that was in effect at the time that Skates was decided and at the time in which these fee agreements were executed. The statute at that time in 5904C provided that the Board of Veterans Appeals would have sua sponte authority to review fee agreements for reasonableness. And the issue in Skates was whether or not that authority was limited. The full court of this court determined that it was, and that proposition was affirmed by the Federal Circuit in Skates. Those were the only issues. There is a lot of what I consider to be dicta in which there are a number of things that were talked about, as Judge Allen suggested, almost in a hypothetical or questioning context, but not relevant to or necessary for the holding. The relevant thing that the Federal Circuit did say is that the veteran has a right to participate in that process, whatever that process may be. At the time in which the Skates decision was made, at the time in which these contracts were entered, there was no statutory provision or regulations that set out what would happen when there was a decision made after the entitlement was made relative to reasonableness, other than on the board's motion or on the motion of any of the parties. After the Skates decision, the Congress amended 5904 at 5904C and changed it from a sua sponte authority to the board to a obligation of the secretary. So it was the secretary's obligation to do both prongs of the review, a review under 5904 and a review under 5904C for reasonableness. The secretary then delegated that responsibility to his general counsel. And the general counsel now, by regulation, reviews upon his motion or the motion of the claimant the question of reasonableness. And the question of reasonableness must be, by statute, initiated by motion. There was no motion. If this court finds that the prior provisions, pre-amendment provisions, were in place, then the question becomes whether or not the board in its 2014 decision already met all of the requirements of 5904C for review for reasonableness. And the limitation in 5904C is that the only authority that the secretary has is to reduce the benefit. The clear error of law made in this case was that the board made a decision, a legal determination, that Mr. Cox was entitled to no fee. There is no statutory provision, no regulation that gives the authority to the secretary to do that. To the contrary, the statute requires a predicate finding that the fee called for was either unreasonable or excessive. Unfortunately, Congress did not define what was meant by those terms or the process by which the secretary, or now by delegation, the general counsel, will make that determination as to whether it's excessive or unreasonable. But the question of whether or not, I'm Mr. sorry, Kirk, yes, sir.
Didn't the new regulation that went into place, there was a new regulation that went into place with respect to this, which is what I'm assuming you're referring to in terms of the delegation to the to the general counsel. That specifically said, I think, that they don't, that these new rules don't apply to fee agreements entered before June 23rd, 2008. And I think all of Mr. Cox's fee agreements were entered prior to that date. So why wouldn't the old regime apply?
Because it conflicts with the statute. The statute is reviewing the fee awarded. The fee was not awarded in this case until after the new regulations went into effect. So, and based upon that, regardless,
I just want to be clear, then, in order to adopt your position that you're articulating now on this point, meaning that the board is without jurisdiction to consider reasonableness in the first instance. That's a shorthand version of the argument.
Yes.
We would need to find invalid the effective date provisions.
Yes.
That VA adopted. Okay, I just want to be clear about that. Thank you.
Yes. I'm sorry, are there other questions before I proceed? Okay. Other pertinent issue in this case, and Judge Allen, you just touched on it with your question, has to do with what the board was authorized to do on remand and whether or not a remand from this court for reasons or bases to address a favorable finding, which was the entitlement to the fee, allows the board to completely readjudicate everything. And there are no cases directly on point. This issue has not been addressed by this court or the Federal Circuit, but it seems evident to Mr. Cox that the intent of Congress, as expressed by the amendment to 7261, A4, to allow for or to preclude this court from reversing favorable findings of fact, would preclude what happened in this case. Because on both salient issues, the first is the entitlement to fee under 5904D, and the second is the reasonableness question, the board spoke to those issues. And in fact, the board
Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Cooper, I want to ask, what about, I mean, there's a regulation, I think it's 20.407, that says that favorable findings, that line that doesn't apply to simultaneously contested claims, right? And I mean, these have been, attorney's fees have been deemed simultaneously contested claims. I mean, do we have to invalidate that regulation?
I think you do, Your Honor, because just as with the other regulation, it's contrary to the plain language of the statute. The secretary is not allowed to write regulations that suit the outcome that he desires. The secretary is obligated to write his regulations in harmony with the plain language of the statute. And the, when Congress amended 7261, it didn't say except for. The secretary is now by regulation said, except for. That's just not a valid regulation on its face. But it seems to me, Your Honor, that this has as much or more to do.
Wouldn't that, though, be problematic to follow on Judge Polk's point? Because in a simultaneously contested claim, one party wins, the other loses, right? And so, I mean, let's take the simple case of I am the veteran spouse. No, I am the veteran spouse. And don't worry about the time. We'll add 5 minutes, Dawn. In that case, right, the losing purported spouse gets to appeal to the court. But if we couldn't review favorable findings to the winning spouse, then the losing spouse's right to appeal is essentially illusory, right? Because if we're precluded from reviewing favorable findings, every finding is favorable to the winner in a situation like that, right? So doesn't there have to be some play in the joints?
Well, on the one hand, I think it is fair to say that Congress may not have contemplated this question when it amended the statute. However, it seems to me that the statute is clear. I agree that this presents a dilemma in a simultaneously contested claim circumstance. But the question is, what is the scope of this court's judicial review of board decisions? And what you're reviewing is a favorable disposition in the context of your hypothetical of the claimant claiming to be the real spouse. In this case, you're reviewing the favorable disposition of both the regional office and the board that Mr. Cox was entitled to the fee. That seems to me, Your Honor, to be a question related to the entitlement to the fee. Now, as I'm sure that the court is aware, I was involved in the simultaneously contested cases before both this court and the Federal Circuit, and I disagree vigorously both at the time and now that that is a correct interpretation, that attorney fees should be considered a simultaneously contested claim. But that ground's been plowed. So we're bound by that. But given that, this court now has to reconcile the statutory mandate from Congress that contains no exception to the intuitive notion that in simultaneously contested claims, that would be unfair. So it seems to me, Your Honor, that if in the example that you offer, that there were favorable decisions made for spouse one, and by inference, unfavorable to spouse two, then this court is indeed bound by the mandate of Congress until Congress changes that. And if Congress gets a decision out of this case that says that you're bound by the plain language of that statute, then it would be up to Congress to change it if Congress felt like that was necessary. Now, in my view, the easier remedy is to simply find that attorney fees aren't simultaneously contested claims. But again, that's an issue for Congress. You know, Congress does have a statutory provision for simultaneously contested claims. But as we found out in the 30 years we've been doing this, that Congress, like the Secretary, failed to define critical terms. A critical term in the simultaneously contested claim statute is, what's a simultaneously contested claim? Now, this court found in deferring to the Secretary's interpretation of that statute that that fit for simultaneously contested claims, and the Federal Circuit agreed. But to me, Your Honor, the issue is what happens when a decision is reviewed by the board and they come to a decision, the appellant in the first appeal was Mr. Brinkley. He was, to use Your Honor's term, the loser in that appeal. He got a remand. Did that remand convert his status to a winner? How could that possibly be? Judge Greenberg took no action to undo the favorable findings made by the 2014 board decision. That would be fundamentally unfair and a denial of due process to Mr. Cox to have those favorable findings of fact and this court's obligation to be bound by them. I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was out of time again.
Well, let me see whether Judge Toth or Judge Falvey has some additional questions, and if not, we'll pick this up on rebuttal. Judge Toth?
I don't. Thanks.
Judge Falvey?
Just a couple of quick questions. I'd like to circle back to Judge Allen's assumptions at the beginning, assuming that Mr. Cox wrote the contract. The contract provides you will not be paid if you're dismissed for adequate cause, and that there's adequate cause here. What would Mr. Brinkley's recourse be if we don't allow VA to withhold that money from Mr. Cox and provide it to Mr. Brinkley?
I believe Mr. Brinkley had his recourse before the 2014 board, and that the 2014 board, I think I can find the exact language that they used, if you'll indulge me for just a moment.
Well, for my purposes, I don't think I need the board language. I guess I've got it here.
Well,
but if he has no recourse to, I guess, go to state court and bring a contract action.
No, but Your Honor, I'm sorry. My answer is he has a recourse in the reasonableness evaluation, and the board in 2014. Relying upon the prior version of the statute and regulation that gave the board sua sponte jurisdiction to review the fee agreement, that the board did that and took into consideration his testimony and his written argument about the contract and determined that there was no basis to reduce the amount of the fee, which is the only option. There is not the final option under Title 38 to do what the board did, which was to say that he's entitled to no fee without a reasonableness or excessiveness analysis as required by statute.
If he's not entitled to the fee under the terms of the agreement, wouldn't that be that any fee would be unreasonable?
Well, that would be a way to read the contract, Your Honor. But the Secretary and the board are not required to read the contract except for those requirements of Title 38. And when reading the statutory mandate of 5904C, the only authority given by Congress is to find that the amount of the fee should be reduced. Okay? Now,
but not reduced to zero.
Well, if you make the analysis, which the board did not on remand, I believe that the board, if they had an adequate statement of reasons or bases, could do that. But, Your Honor, the problem here is that Board 1 came to a diametrically opposite conclusion than Board 2.
Do you
and
think
offered
that we could,
no reasons.
Do you think we could get to get to a resolution where Mr. Cox receives his fee without reaching all the precedential questions you're raising? For example, that you make the case that, oh, we're bound by the favorable findings. If we just said we're bound by the favorable findings, do we need to reach any of those other issues?
No, I don't believe you do, Your Honor. And that's why I framed my issues in terms of the board on remand exceeded its authority or didn't have the subject matter jurisdiction to venture into the areas in which they ventured into.
Do you know if Mr. Brinkley has been paid the $58,000?
No, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, my client has been paid that, and it's been sitting in his trust account for more than a decade.
Okay. Great, thank you.
And I do not know whether or not, based upon the 2019 board decision, the secretary went ahead and paid Mr. Brinkley. I can't find any information to that effect in the claims file.
Okay, perhaps we'll ask them. Them. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. We'll pick you up, and we've preserved all your rebuttal time. Mr. Youssef, whenever you're ready.
Good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Court should affirm the May 2019 Board decision for two reasons. First, the Board complied with the Court's 2016 remand instructions to reassess the fee agreement to include the quantum merit provision and the governing statutory and regulatory provisions authorized the Board to review a fee agreement as well as to reduce a fee award if necessary. And second, appellant fails to show clear error or even argue that the board made a clear error in finding that he was discharged for good cause based on the nature of his representation. Your Honors, as to the first point, the court remanded this case in 2016 on the grounds that the board ignored the terms of the fee agreement, specifically the quantum merit provision that provided that a fee award would only be warranted if Mr. Brinkley discharged Mr. Cox without good and adequate cause. Your Honor, all of the parties, as the board, appellant, and the court have acknowledged and found, the fee agreement is valid, which includes the terms, the quantum merit stipulation, and the parties are therefore bound by the valid and binding terms of that contract. Furthermore, Your Honors, neither party disputes that the veteran, Mr. Brinkley, properly contested the payment of fees to Mr. Cox, thereby authorizing the board to review the fee agreement and make any proposed reductions or appropriate reductions. Nor does any party here dispute that the fee agreement contains the quantum merit provision. Therefore, in accordance with its statutory authority under 5904C3A, as well as in compliance with the court's remand instructions, the board properly evaluated the fee agreement, considered the quantum merit provision, and found that appellant was discharged for good cause and therefore not entitled to attorney fees. Your Honor, we would also agree with the proposition that this case is akin to a simultaneously contested claim where the board's prior decision, the favorable findings, would not be binding. If we were to find that, then the veteran in this case, Mr. Cox, would essentially be deprived of the opportunity to appeal or contest that determination. Your Honors, as to the second reason that the court should affirm the board's decision, again, the appellant fails to show that the board made a clear error in finding that he was discharged for good cause.
Mr.
The board
before you transition your second, could you respond directly to Mr. Carpenter's point about whether the new regime, I'm going to call it, the regime that assigns the reasonableness assessment in the first instance to the general counsel. Whether the effective date provision that the secretary put into that change should be deemed, inappropriate.
Yes, sir. We would respectfully disagree with that. We think that the scheme that was in place at the time of the fee agreements should apply. So the prior regulations, 20.609, would be the ones that apply here. And we think that they are consistent with the statute, with 5904. Your Honor, continuing with the second point, appellant fails to show or argue clear error in the board's determination that he was discharged for good cause. The board found that Mr. Brinkley had good cause to terminate their relationship because appellant did not comply with the standards of conduct that were to be expected of his representation. The board looked at VA regulations as well as the rules of professional conduct as espoused by Mr. Cox's state bar where he is licensed. And in doing so, the board found that Mr. Cox fell short of these standards. This included not returning his phone calls or being accessible via the phone, canceling a hearing that Mr. Brinkley was entitled to and presumably wanted to attend, not helping to develop the claim to its optimum, and not assisting him with paperwork. You know, these are allegations that Mr. Brinkley made routinely that the board found and that were not contradicted or otherwise contested, I should say, by Mr. Cox on appeal. Because appellant does not meet his burden of showing clear error, as well as the first point that that we raised, we think that the court should affirm the board's decision as it was a plausible determination, and there's no demonstration of clear error by the appellant here.
Counsel, I have a quick question. So let's assume that the good and adequate cause provision was absent from the contract. Could the board or VA have made the same ruling?
Your Honor,
I'll give you a second. I'll reframe it and I'll kind of give you a second to think about it. So, I mean, I guess a different way to look at it would be the same question I asked Mr. Carpenter, which is, does an actual interpretation of the term good and adequate cause, does this case turn on that?
Your Honor, so we would submit that the good and adequate cause is central to the case, but even if the provision wasn't there, we think that the board and the agency would still have the authority to look at it and presumably to make the same determination if it so chose. In Skates, the Federal Circuit held that an attorney with a contingent fee agreement would not automatically be entitled to the full 20%. He's only entitled to the amount that fairly reflects his contribution to the claim. And, the Federal Circuit explained that this was actually to ensure adequate representation for veterans if the attorney was discharged prior to the completion of the claim. That, Your Honor, we think is central to this case because in that context, we think that the board acted within the scope of its authority as well as within the scope of 5904. And we think that that is the central point here.
So am I understanding you correctly that you would read Skates, basically you would read the court there saying that 5904 has, there's sort of a condition precedent for 5904 that's implicit, which is that the attorney successfully complete the representation to even to qualify for 5904.
Well, Your Honor, we would read Skates to say that to qualify for the automatic presumption of 20%, the attorney would have to complete the case. Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, we submit that these are the reasons that the court should affirm the board's decision.
Before you sit down, but that ship has sailed. I'm going to pitch this as a question to Mr. Carpenter as well. So, but since you don't get to come up again, I want to get your reaction to it. What about thinking about entitlement and reasonableness like this? And I'm stealing this from one of my law clerks, okay? that essentially entitlement is in some respects sort of part of reasonableness in the sense that it turns on some amount of light, right? Like a dimmer switch. The reasonableness calculation tells you how much light you're going to have, right? So if you had a dimmer switch, you can be half on or three quarters on, right? But you can also be off, and the off is entitlement, right? If you don't trigger that at all, then you never move into how much do you have, because the entitlement gives you only zero. This isn't a trick question. That's how I am conceptualizing this. What do you think of that?
Your Honor, I think the issues of entitlement and reasonableness, and Skates discussed this to an extent. We would submit that they are distinct concepts, but as the Federal Circuit explained, and as it seems to me, Your Honor, you're alluding to, that they can often overlap and one may involve the other. I think we would submit that entitlement is generally a threshold question, which in that sense would probably be akin to your analysis of being the switch that you turn on and off. But we think that reasonableness can be encompassed, or I'm sorry, entitlement can be encompassed within reasonableness.
Well, let me just why I'm asking this is that, there are a lot of fee cases at the Federal Circuit. There's a lot of fee cases at our court. And sometimes because there's a specific issue in a case, the cases use loose language. And I initially, when I read your brief, I liked the fact that you had four things, right? There was validity, eligibility, entitlement, and reasonableness. But then interestingly, when you go back and you try to attach those concepts to a regulation, say, for example, you can easily do that with validity. You can easily do that with eligibility. You can easily do that with reasonableness. But there actually isn't a statute or regulation that uses the word entitlement. So I've been thinking how, but clearly that concept is implicit to get any fee, right? You couldn't get a reasonable fee if you are entitled to nothing, right? So entitlement has to be part of it. And that's what I was trying to figure out, is where in the concepts that the statutes and regulations use, validity, eligibility, and reasonableness, how do we then articulate what entitlement is? And so what I was trying to lay out was a possibility that it's sort of a threshold to reasonableness, because reasonableness says, okay, you've got a valid agreement, you are eligible to get a fee, meaning all of though you ticked off those eligibility requirements that are in the regulation. Now we have to figure out how much. Well, the first question to how much is there any, meaning entitlement? Once you say yes, then the question is how much you get, right? And Skates is particularly relevant to that. So I just wanted to get your reaction to that potential framework, because I was intrigued by how we get to entitlement as a concept.
Yes, Your Honor, I think we would agree with that, I guess, kind of that layout of how the two terms can often work and how one may encompass the other. Your Honor, we would point out that even within the board decision itself, this kind of plays out to an extent where the board did not, in fact, the board found that a finding on reasonableness, an actual finding, was unnecessary, but the board did note the factors. And I think the specific factors that are critical here, which were noted in Skates, were the reason for why the attorney was discharged prior to the completion of the claim, as well as whether the attorney could recover under another legal theory, like the quantum merit provision, actually, is what the Federal Circuit noted. And Your Honor, that is central to this claim. And we think that if we were to look at it through this, I don't want to say alternative lens, but this this hypothetical, Your Honor, that you're discussing, even if we were to look at it from that perspective, we think that it would not be reasonable in this case for Mr. Cox to receive fees because of the terms of the agreement. The parties entered into this willingly, and Your Honor, as you yourself indicated, that Mr. Cox probably drafted the terms. So he was aware, and both parties were aware. So under those terms, Your Honor, it would not be reasonable from our perspective for the determination to be made that Mr. Cox would be entitled to fees in this case, especially when we consider it as you laid out. Respectfully, Your Honor, I would also, with the court's permission, point the court to 5301, which essentially states that the secretary cannot divert a veteran's benefits unless authorized by law. 5904D, which discusses the payment of fees from past due benefits, we think works within that as an exception where the secretary does withhold funds or disperse funds for attorney's fees from the veteran's benefits if the veteran consents. And the veteran's consent for us is shown through the executed fee agreement itself. But Your Honor, we don't have that here. We have a situation where the veteran did not consent to a disbursement of funds within this context, within this specific fact scenario. So we would submit that 5904D operates in that sense. And as I articulated earlier, 5904C3A, you know, we respectfully disagree with my respected colleague that 5904C3A does give the secretary, the agency, the authority to review and enforce the fee agreement if necessary.
Given, this is Judge Falvey, given what you just said, has the veteran been paid his benefits, the full $58,000 that was withheld originally?
Your Honor, Mr. Cox was paid in December 2015. The agency did disperse funds, but the agency has not yet released those funds or reallocated those funds back to the veteran. The agency is just waiting the outcome of the current litigation.
Okay. What is, if we were to agree with Mr. Carpenter, what would be the veteran's recourse if he disagreed at this point?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, if the court were to disagree, we think that would place the veteran at an enormous disadvantage because he would have to seek an alternative venue, presumably. But here, Your Honor, we have this statutory scheme, which is designed to ensure that veterans are protected within within these situations, especially when it comes to providing adequate representation. And we think that finding in favor of the appellant in this case would actually deprive him of that right and deprive him of that opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Toth, do you have any questions?
I have nothing further. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Youssef.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Carpenter, you've got your 10 minutes of rebuttal time.
Oh, there it is. Okay. I was having trouble getting my mute unmuted. I would like to start with this observation. There are two board decisions in this case. The first board decision was fully favorable to Mr. Cox. The second board decision was fully favorable to Mr. Brinkley. In both decisions, a veterans law judge acting as agent for the secretary made credibility determinations implicitly about the representations made by Mr. Brinkley. In the first board decision, those representations about the adequacy of representation by Mr. Cox were rejected. In the second board decision, they were accepted. That's why this case is a critical case for this court to write on in order for all parties to understand what the relationship is when you get a favorable board decision in a contested claim as an attorney, and the veteran takes an appeal. If you get a remand, as you got in this case, what is the legal impact? What is the consequence of that remand on the prevailing party before the board the first time? Put another way, does the board decision have any law of the case, res judicata impact on the disposition on remand, particularly when the reason for the remand was a reasons or bases to explain the favorable disposition? Nothing in that remand directed the second veterans law judge to review under 5904D. Nothing in that remand directed the veterans law judge to review for reasonableness. Yet both board decisions involved a review for reasonableness. And once again, we have decision one, fully favorable to Mr. Cox. And decision two, we have a decision that is fully favorable to Mr. Brinkley. This creates a serious problem with the consequences of a remand. And what jeopardy, particularly in the context of a fee dispute, that puts the former prevailing party. And all that was asked by Judge Greenberg was to address the provisions of the fee agreement. Judge Greenberg did not direct the board on remand to revisit either the question of entitlement or the question of reasonableness. And yet that's sort of what the board did in the second bite of the apple, but they actually went further because they made a specific legal determination that they didn't need to review for reasonableness because they made the disposition based upon the contents of the fee agreement.
Mr. Carpenter, doesn't this gets to the point I was discussing with Mr. Youssef? I mean, isn't the once one says that there's a valid agreement and that the specific eligibility requirements have been satisfied, right? Isn't it the question of entitlement? It seems to me is inextricably tied to then reasonableness, right? Because if you are entitled to zero, right, we can call that entitlement, we can call it reasonableness, right? But if you're not entitled to anything, then I don't understand why, even under your take on the case, it was inappropriate for the board to reassess that, even under the narrower view of the remand. Because if the contract said you get zero if you're discharged for good and adequate cause, and Judge Greenberg said, discuss good and adequate cause, then the board discussing it and saying this was good and adequate cause complies with the remand, and it also settles the question of entitlement, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor, it does not, because there is no statutory authority for the board to make the equation that the good and adequate cause for discharge authorizes a non-award of a fee. And there is no provision in 5904D for anything other than meeting the requirements under 5904D to be paid the fee that's called for in that fee agreement. The next step is one that required...
So could the board... This is fanciful, okay? But if what you're saying is there's no statutory authority to enforce the terms of the contract that say zero in this situation, right? This is following on something that Judge Falvey asked, I think, at the end of your argument, although I'm taking it farther. So could the board then say, okay, we can't give zero because we can't enforce the terms of the contract, but we can take a whole bunch of stuff into account as part of the reasonableness analysis from SCAPE, And so we award you a dollar. And so they could award a dollar, but not zero?
Your Honor, to me, there is only one way to answer that, and that is to answer it hypothetically. Hypothetically, given what you have described, that would be true. However, the problem with the hypothetical is that it presumes statutory authority to review for reasonableness. And a examination of 5904C, whether under the, let's call it Skates version of the authority to review for reasonableness, which was vested with the board, which is what was done by the board in the 2014 decision. We now have a board decision that did in fact take into consideration the testimony and the written argument made by Mr. Brinkley and rejected that testimony as influencing the entitlement to receive that fee. And in fact found that notwithstanding the representations of Mr. Brinkley, that there was a basis for and an entitlement to a $50,000 plus fee by Mr. Cox. Now, this entire process is a function of Congress. Congress created 5904D. I am unaware of any comparable statute to 5904D that is based upon specific criteria, which if met, imposes an obligation on the part of the federal agency to pay the attorney's fee. And I believe that this court in Littman recognized that the 5904D fee process was independent of the 5904C entitlement to a fee. And 5904C has two subsections, one that deals with the entitlement to the fee, the right to charge a fee, and the other provision is the provision relative to reasonableness. And the mandate of Congress is that reasonableness will only be visited upon motion. And that motion was either authorized under the prior version or authorized or not authorized, under the prior version, reasonableness was to be done by the board in the first instance. This court in Bonk, in Skates, and the Federal Circuit said you can review for reasonableness, but what you can't do is to review for entitlement under 5904D. So if you can't do that, you can't make that review for reasonableness in the first instance, then the only way you can do it is to do it by motion. No motion was made here. Mr. Cox was not put on notice by the second board decision that he intended to make that review. So there is a profound denial of due process to Mr. Cox if this court says that the 2019 board action was permissible under the statutory scheme because there simply is no authority to do what the board did. And what the court asked for in the review was reasons or bases, not for a disposition. Judge Greenberg had before him a disposition.
Judge Toth, do you have questions?
I do not, thank you.
Judge Falvey?
I do not, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You want to wrap up, Mr. Carpenter?
Actually, I don't believe it's necessary, Your Honor. You've heard more than enough from me.
Well, never, Mr. Carpenter. We want to thank both you and Mr. Youssef for very helpful arguments this morning. And so the case is submitted. Thank you.
And the court is in recess.